We're not starting a revolution. We're watching Flight of the Navigator in an ill-informed attempt to use nostalgia to try to get us through a global pandemic. Welcome to Replaying Favorites. It's the podcast where two friends show each other a movie that both of them have seen, but haven't seen in a long time. We're on the five, so we're switching up the format a little bit. And I'm Brie Callahan.
I'm Chris Kelly.
And this week, we are going to watch 1986's Flight of the Navigator, a Norwegian-American sci-fi adventure movie that both of us watched religiously as children, but that neither of us have seen in like 30 years. So this is memory hold for both of us. Chris, what do you remember about Flight of the Navigator?
Very, very little. I think part of it is that I might have conflated some of it with E.T. For instance, cannot picture the young lead male in this at all. I just see Elliot. But I know that this is a movie about a young boy who is, for some reason, removed from his home early in the movie. He meets Sarah Jessica Parker and then subsequently meets a spaceship. End of list.
Okay. I have better recall on it. I don't want to accidentally spoil you for any parts that you don't remember. I feel like possibly in the back third of the movie, I don't remember exactly what happens. But that is what this podcast is about, is watching movies that we have or have not seen and then talking about them together. So we probably don't want to belabor this one. Why don't we just keep it moving?
Yeah, I'm interested to see what I liked about this so much as a child. I look forward to watching it.
There's a border collie that catches frisbees, so we're in good hands here, and we'll see you after the break. Welcome back from the break. We have both watched 1986's Flight of the Navigator. A brief recap. It is July 4th, 1978, and 12-year-old David is walking in the woods to find his brother. He falls and is knocked out, and when he wakes up, he goes home to find that 8 years have passed, and it's now 1986. Across town, NASA has discovered a spaceship. David and the spaceship are connected, and NASA keeps him for 48 hours to run tests. David and the spaceship, helmed by an alien called Max, escape NASA, and David learns that he has star charts that are needed by Max to help him get home. After they transfer the files, they take David home, but he realizes that he can't stay in this weird present, and the two of them take the risk to travel back in time and drop him home in 1978. It stars Joey Kramer as David, Paul Rubens under a different name as Max the alien, Sarah Jessica Parker, and Howard Hessman. It was made for $9 million and it made back $18.5 million and is yet another movie scored by Alan Silvestri. I do think we might need to do a check and see if we are not just running an Alan Silvestri podcast. Chris, what did you think of this long-lost favorite?
So I want to start by saying that my first two notes are, well, this opening song sure is cool, followed by the always welcome Alan Silvestri, because his credit came up 2 seconds after I was like, what is this hot synth riff that I am listening to?
It is very reminiscent of his work in The Long Kiss Goodnight. I will say that the opening to this movie is perhaps the most for me opening to a film of all time. It's just dogs chasing frisbees. And I'm like, 2 more hours of this, please. Let's not get on with the time travel nonsense.
I also have, if not a quibble, at least a question about your plot summary. You repeatedly refer to Max as an alien. I believe Max is a computer program, yes?
I don't know. I guess he's running the ship, and maybe the ship was sent by the Phalons or whatever. Maybe he is not a Phalon himself?
My understanding was that Max is simply the ship's computer, which is why he doesn't develop a personality until he scans the little boy's brain.
I mean, he's an alien computer.
I will take that. Yes, he is. I just thought maybe I missed something about him being like, because it's just a weird little like metallic arm coming out of the ceiling. I was like, is there a living thing in that?
Well, since we don't know what the people who live on that planet are like, maybe the ship is the alien. I don't think we should overthink it.
I mean, we could end the episode now, but I think we should probably overthink some things.
I meant specifically about Max, but I kind of do also mean about Flight of the Navigator. It seems like you might have liked this one slightly more than I did.
Okay, let me explain to you my experience with this film.
Okay.
I think we actually do have a long kiss goodnight situation here. When the first half was a weird mystery about why this child lost 8 years of his life, I was all in. When he went home and he didn't recognize the people in his house, I was in full tears.
Aw, it's a really tough scene, actually. Joey Kramer does really good work. Like, that boy is doing full-ass tears in numerous, numerous scenes.
Yeah, and it's not until halfway through that he even gets on the ship. Once that happens, this is just a children's movie. But I was into the first 45 minutes hard.
My structuring of it would be a little different. I think it's like three different parts. It's like the stuff with David, the science ship stuff, and the mystery behind that. And then the weird, inexplicable, and unnecessary road trip that takes up the back third.
Also, you remembered a lot more of this movie. I realized going in that I was like, a lot of this vaguely rings a bell, but you seemed to have a stronger sense of what we were in for. Did watching this conform to your expectations?
Yes, right up until about the two-thirds mark, with the exception of exactly what Sarah Jessica Parker's role was. I misremembered that a little bit. And I remember, like, Max suddenly having this different personality, but then it's like I blacked out the whole road trip part, and then I remembered him getting dropped back at home at the end. I don't know. I guess my personality was, like, set from the egg. Like, I find the whole section where Paul Reubens is, like, given free rein to act wacky, it's like my brain just blotted it out.
I remembered the ship having what I assumed was like a genie from Aladdin kind of personality, where he always had like a million voices at his disposal. And so I was very surprised when it was a very straightforward sort of robotic presence. And then I was also surprised that he was like 95% just Pee-wee Herman. Like, he did a couple other voices, but like most of it was really in the Pee-wee Herman wheelhouse that felt, I don't want to say confusing because I see where it came from, but it didn't feel like the best choice.
So what's funny about it is, and here we'll go into the 5 minutes of research I did, is that this movie came out like 2 months before Pee-wee Herman's Playhouse premiered. I think Pee-wee's Big Adventure is like 84, and then this comes out in like August, and then Pee-wee's Playhouse starts like, I don't know, a month or two later.
So the logical leap there, unfortunately, is that the character would have been in the zeitgeist for the audience who would have seen it. But David, our lead character, has been away for 8 years and would not have had Pee-wee Herman in his brain, even though that is supposedly the source of Pee-wee Herman for the computer.
Oh, I definitely never put that together and still did not until you just said it. So I'm learning a lot in this episode. The alien is not actually an alien. The voice that he gives him couldn't have been stripped from that child's brain. Go fig.
Well, Max, as a researcher, seems pretty shitty. His mission is to go to each planet and grab one living being. That's not really a good sample size.
But then there's also a part about how they just, like, decide to fill up David's brain with as much junk as they can to see, like, if you can get up to 100% capacity, and then his brain leaks, which we never come back to, mind.
I guess we are meant to assume that filling his brain up to 100% didn't hurt him in any way, but did help because then he had all the star charts needed for Max to get back home. So it was a lucky experiment that they haphazardly performed on their one specimen.
Yeah, they tried to break his brain and it just so happens that they didn't. Don't worry about it. I'm sure it's fine. Also, it's 8 years in the future.
Hey, we have to talk about the leak moment because that is my one memory from this film. Disney has edited this movie, I'm 100% certain.
Okay.
When David is getting off the ship, he specifically says to Max, I have to take a leak.
Yeah.
Did I just miss that line? Was it in this one?
Yeah, I mean, he goes and he pees.
But does he say the line, I have to take a leak? He and Max have a conversation about the term to take a leak. And so Max, several times later in the movie, references his brain leaking. He references Max leaking. But there is a conversation that sparks that, which is that the two of them spar back and forth about the meaning of the phrase to take a leak, because that's important to set up those other conversations. Disney has apparently edited that out because I don't know if it's too vulgar for their lead boy to have said that. They still show him peeing. We just don't hear him talk about it.
I am like kind of remembering what you're talking about. And now we have to get to the bottom of this like huge mystery. I don't know how we'll do it because we're recording this now and we probably won't go back in and like loop audio, but we'll let you know on Twitter maybe.
I'm just glad to know that you kind of remember this too, that there was a part of the movie that happened that we didn't see this time around. I'm certain it was there.
I definitely remember David saying, like, pull over or whatever, like, I gotta take a leak, and then the stairs opening up and him, like, going down and peeing. But, like, I didn't remember the gator park or, like, anything else. So why don't we go on back to 1978, and we'll talk a little bit about David and his family and what happens to him that brings this mystery on. Going back to the credits, like, the first thing that was very noticeable, aside from the very delightful dogs, my memory was that the dogs were doing just like really crazy, insane jumps. And some of the dogs are just like, hop.
There are definite shots where the dogs don't even catch the frisbee. They have these majestic slow motion arcs of a dog missing the catch. I'm like, you have better takes. Come on, guys.
But one of the things that you also notice from the credits is just a wild number of people and production companies. And I think that might explain why this feels a little jumbled and a little thrown together in places, because it has the feeling of too many cooks by the time we get to the end of the movie. And I think that that is evident from the front.
Yeah. As you know, I have a brain disorder where I have to read all of the IMDb trivia for every movie that I see. And IMDb said that this apparently started as an independent film that was then picked up by a bigger company. And I think you're right that I would imagine the mystery parts of this are easier for a smaller company to think that they could handle. And then Disney came along and was like, what if we added big budget special effects of a boy flying across the nation? And everyone's like, oh, I don't know if that's really the story we're telling. And they're like, it is now. Like,
and some border collies at the beginning, just for fun.
Slow-mo, miss that frisbee.
So right up the top, there are just a number of 1980s cringe moments. Like the R word gets trotted out almost immediately. There are no seatbelts in any car and no one has anything to say about it. Like, it is so jarring watching some of that shit that was just like typical for the time. Though my guess is that this is 1986 commenting on like the whimsy and like lax parenting in 1978.
Oh, this movie would not have happened if not for lax 1970s parenting, because they are driving down the road. Their youngest child is like, can I get out and play with my friends? And they just toss him out the car without checking with anybody. Like, are the parents even home at that house? It appears to be just feral children in the lawn. Like,
it's like shirtless swamp children.
And then they assume, A, that he will walk home through the woods, and B, they're just like, let's send our only two offspring into the wilderness unattended in the dark.
See, that is just 2021 helicopter parenting for you. There's something kind of delightful about it because we don't let children do that kind of thing anymore. And I think we've lost something as a culture as a result. But also, Jesus Christ, it's wild to see.
I might have even encouraged my children at the time to be like, maybe stay on the street. There's clearly roads between the houses. They drop them off in a goddamn car. Like, stay on the sidewalk, bud.
I don't know. Maybe it's the shortest path home.
I guess it turns out to have not gone that well. So in hindsight, maybe staying under the streetlights was the move.
We are also on week two in our ongoing series of young boys that should be shot into the sun.
Oh, man. That little brother.
Fuck that kid. Fuck that kid.
I know that we're supposed to want them to like make up and have a better relationship. And I'm like, no, no, no. Throw him out the back of that station wagon.
Drop him into the ravine, tie him to the train tracks. Like, David has a lot of options at his disposal, and it is disappointing that he takes none of them. Send that kid off on the spaceship. Be like, you should take my brother back to Phalon.
Oh my God.
Don't return.
If he's the only representation of this whole planet, we are getting nuked.
I feel so bad for little kids who get cast as like a horrible, terrible person that no one wants to be friends with.
I'm sure he did fine. He grew up into a perfectly nice 16-year-old, which, I mean, a nice 16-year-old boy is rare, so good for him.
Let's come back to the nice 16-year-old brother. I feel like their relationship is weird.
Trying circumstances.
Exactly. So we also have a couple bonding moments with each parent, the young, hot parent, before we get the like old, stressed out parents later. One of my favorite moments is when David is talking to his dad, who has looked through the telescope to see his son spying on another child. David, all you got to do is hit that telescope a little bit there, bud. And David says, how are you supposed to talk to girls? And then gets out all of the world's fireworks. Who keeps fireworks in your bedroom, guys?
I immediately took a note that was, is this whole story about him learning to talk to girls? I was already envisioning the final moment of this movie when he triumphantly says hello to that girl in the boat. And we're supposed to be like, yes, he learned to stalk appropriately. And I'm so glad that we didn't get there.
Yeah, his dad has zero reaction to him just like scoping, literally with a scope, a telescope, some young girl who seems like she was probably just minding her own business.
In the standards of 1978, that made him a goddamn catch. They're like, he's watching out for her.
She made the mistake of being nice to him. She gets what she deserves, I guess.
Oh, man. The past and the present, both terrible.
Both very bad. Look, let's get David into the ravine. Nobody cares about the 1978 world. David, looking for his brother, falls into a ravine. He wakes up, Bruiser the dog is no longer there. He wanders home, and I think you're correct to say, in one of the movie's most affecting scenes, David gets to his own home and realizes that other people are living there. And I remember connecting with that a lot as a kid. Like, what a horrifying situation for a seventh grader to come home and some other family is living there.
Yeah, I didn't remember that scene from having seen it initially. So I was quite shocked when it happened. As you said, he plays that scene with a reality that was really distressing to watch. Like, he's clearly in a lot of stress. He's really thrown off and he ends up just like crumbling into a ball and sobbing on the stairs. I was actively crying watching it. Part of me was like, am I just having a day? Like, is this unrelated to the movie? Which is possible.
Is this just pandemic?
And partially, yes. But also, I was like, am I going to be connected to this whole movie? I had, like, a lot of introspection to do after crying at that scene. I'm not going to lie.
Okay, well, this podcast is a little bit like therapy in the sense that you... I didn't actually have anything
there. I was about to say, I don't think it is, but I can't wait to hear how you're going to make that happen.
I could not. And thus we continue with the podcast. One of the things that I think is the most unsettling about that house is Larry, the husband, who's at home in David's bedroom. He gives off like a real creep vibe that I don't understand. And the gentleman is clearly like not creepy and wants to help David, but he just gives like a real bleh.
You know what it is? He doesn't seem to have an activity in that room. He seems to be just sitting. Like, his only purpose is to be, I guess, avoiding his wife. It feels very strange that he's just, like, alone in an empty room, not doing anything.
Maybe he's looking in on Jennifer or whoever the fuck out on the boat still. She's probably, oh, she's of age now, probably. Great, good for her.
I don't know if that makes it even a little bit better. I guess a very little bit.
I mean, I always got the real sense as a child that, like, David felt like he was going to be harmed by that man, and I felt it too. Like, that guy creeped me out as a kid, and I was glad to see that looking at it with adult eyes, like, once he stands up and just starts talking to him, he's a normal man. But the 80s really trained kids to react very negatively to, hey, son, why don't you come here? I just want to explain something to you. We got so much stranger dangered, like, into oblivion that, like, anyone who approaches me without malice, I'm like, what do you want? This is a lie.
Oh, man. The satanic panic harmed us.
Yeah. Well, and also we were all fingerprinted as youth, so.
Wait, you were fingerprinted?
Oh, you did not get fingerprinted?
Not that I can recall.
I wonder if this is like a big city, small town thing. Guys, go on our Twitter page. Let us know if you got fingerprinted as a kid. We're going to run a study.
No, I'm seriously curious. Yeah, please fill us in.
Anyway,
let's get back to 1986. David is escorted by the police to his parents in their new home. They've been through a really rough 8 years, and he is distressed to learn that.
Both parents look like they have been begreased in a way that I don't understand. Bless the PA that had to find the second house for the family. Best I can tell, it is surrounded by highways on all sides.
I did like that you sort of got all of the shorthand of what a tough 8 years it was for them. The new house is not as nice as the old house, so you can see the financial toll without it ever being mentioned. They are grayer and tireder than 8 years would have made them. They did a lot of detail work to just show, like, these people have been wrung out.
Yeah, the mother and father's relationship is a little bit more stilted because they've lost a child and it seems like they don't know how to deal with it. And their relationship with their remaining son also seems like he's grown up in a different way than he would have if David had not gone missing. It's pretty good character work from the three actors that are asked to take that on.
Absolutely. I was impressed throughout with the acting work of the family. I expected to come into a much fluffier, frankly, overall worse film. And the sense of fatigue that they convey just answering the door, a police car driving up, was something that they weren't necessarily looking forward to.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
I might have still been getting over my tears from the last scene. It's fine, I'm an emotional person, but I think I was still like a little racked by that. And I was like, oh God, they think they're about to be told that they found a body.
Luckily, I think for me, I knew that things were okay, but there's also the really great moment of David getting out of the car and his dad is in shadow, so he doesn't see what he looks like. And he runs up and he sees that his dad looks different and he freaks out. It is hard for a kid to relate to a parent that looks really different from what they remember them looking like. And you see that moment too from Joey Kramer. He's really great in this, actually. He didn't have a ton of work after this, and I think it's kind of a shame.
An acting choice that didn't work for me, actually. Neither of his parents in that initial scene seem at all concerned that a 12-year-old boy is being brought to them. They should very much expect to be meeting a 20-year-old as their son.
I mean, they do immediately take him to the hospital for a large number of tests. And when we get to the hospital, that's when we finally get to meet the now 16-year-old little brother of David, who is given a lot of lift in this movie. The parents are like kind of wrecked. And I think you see them leaning on their son to kind of have like emotional reactions to his brother returning.
And this is, some of it is the script, some of it is the performances, but it was really refreshing to see that level of intricacy in what could have just been like, oh, David's back, we're all celebrating. Like they seem to have worked to make sure that you understand that, like, everyone has 8 years of baggage to deal with, and that's not swept aside.
Counterpoint, the shirt on Jeff at 16 is hilarious. It is floral, and it has the biggest armholes I've ever seen on a short sleeve shirt in my life. I'm just bringing us back to the fundamentals of this podcast, which is not, like, emotional complexity, but is instead, look at them costumes.
They really worked hard to let you know that Jeff has had a hard life, but Jeff's cool.
That kid is also wearing so much cake makeup in a way that no one else is. What did they do to him? Was he like 35 and they were trying to age him down?
I didn't look up his age. My two theories were 30 or acne.
Bad skin. Yeah, that was my other one. Sorry, random Jeff kid. You're fine. You did great. All right, let's leave this complex emotional drama aside and talk about the spaceship that they find.
So right off the bat, they want to play the spaceship seriously, but then also can't really get a handle on that. Like, the first thing that happens is that the security guard is like, hey, watch this. And he just, like, pushes it. And I was like, yo, no one's being that careful with this thing. Maybe we should all take a step back and not just slam it around and see what happens.
Massive shout out, as always, to Herman Hesman, who is the delight of anything that he's in. So this movie has a real vibe of the sort of last gasp of NASA being really cool. The sort of probable reason for that is that this movie comes out in like September or October of 1986, and the Challenger was in January of 1986. So this movie comes out just about 9 months after grade school children across America like watched NASA explode a space shuttle.
For $1 billion, if you had asked me if we would ever mention the Challenger disaster on this podcast, I would have said no.
Have you heard the last handful of episodes? Every week, I'm like, try not to bring in some like esoteric garbage that only you know and care about. And every week, I trot out some stupid ass fact that is like relevant, but not appreciated or nice. So sorry, guys. I mean, what's kind of crazy about this is that this is a NASA that has like a real dark side.
Yeah, I was really surprised that they asked to take David alone and that his parents were like, sure. They just got him back. If I were his parents, I'd be like, one of us is going to come with because he's been gone for 8 years. Like,
yeah, the parents are a little trusting. I guess that's why I bring up the Challenger, is that like, I could see if this movie was made after the Challenger explosion, how you'd be like, wow, NASA actually has a lot of problems and like, let's explore them in a movie. But it is funny that this movie seems to have arrived at NASA as maybe slightly incompetent and maybe a little sketchy on its own, but it's very fascinating to me as a human, and I will stop talking about that now.
Let's talk instead about Sarah Jessica Parker.
This is such a weird role.
Very strange.
My memory was that she was way more of a character, was a teen, which obviously makes no sense because she's an intern, and is having this kind of like vaguely inappropriate flirty-ish relationship with a 12-year-old. Chris, what is her job at the facility?
It is to walk next to a robot.
She makes a point of saying that she's looked up the meals that are going to the others for the rest of the week. How many people is NASA detaining and doing experiments on? Because it seems like a lot.
Yeah, that was my sort of question, too, is that she seems pretty used to the function of helping out with detainees. Like, you shouldn't have an intern for that in the first place. They have a room all set up for him. Like, it's all a little rote.
By the time you have developed a robot in order to help, you're keeping a lot of people in cages, is basically the point.
We now know that the government does do that. My recollection of Sarah Jessica Parker was that it was her idea to put him in the robot. I didn't remember the context surrounding it.
Me too.
I was certain that she was the one who had the idea and was really surprised when
she does nothing.
Yeah. He tells her to look up his parents. She says that she will get him a Big Mac and can't. She has no use.
She doesn't get him the burger. She doesn't call his parents as he requests her to do. She does nothing.
She does visit his parents personally, which takes longer and is less helpful. And NASA, like, detains her after that, and we never see her again. I was kind of worried. I'm like, did Sarah Jessica Parker get offed? Like, what happened?
Yeah, she's just, like, grabbed by a man, and then we never hear from her again. Who in 1985 was just like, those NASA fuckers, I bet they're up to something.
Listen, they'll let you have purple hair at work, so progressive workplace.
Oh, please. And that girl, she reaches, she's like, oh, this purple hair? I forgot I even had, no, you did not. You did not forget that you had the purple hair, because I remembered it from the time that I was 7.
Also, you can't feel whether your hair is purple. So if you went and grabbed it, you know that it's purple. She wasn't checking a mirror.
I love everything about this weird part of the movie. It's a robot for robot's sake. It only makes more work.
Yeah, no, the robot is only there because it's the only way to get him out of the facility. They need a robot that is big enough for a whole child to fit in.
It carries mail and meals to detainees. That's weird, NASA.
Sarah Jessica Parker might not have a lot to do, but she has both arms. She can carry mail and meals all by herself.
And also, how much mail are the detainees sending out? Is like, I don't know.
Yeah, get her a push cart. That's all she needs.
There are some cool things that happen with like the science of this movie. I do love that the movie takes the time to explain what binary is. In 1986, that was just not something that was accessible to the general public. And I love seeing those like pieces of archaicness in our culture.
It's funny because they take some time to get some of the science at least vaguely right, but they also do things like they have the computer screen flashing just like half-second images of a bunch of things, and the scientists are like, oh, those are star charts we've never seen before. I'm like, you couldn't tell what it was going that quickly. That could have been anything. That could have been a picture of a new car. Like, you don't know what solar system that is. Come on.
I don't really have any complaints. It's very fun. It gets the point across that David has in his brain a ton of things that NASA is not equipped to understand, and that it is probably related to his 8-year disappearance.
And we are still, at this point in the plot, in a situation that I am firmly into. Like, I didn't remember that that stuff was there, but I was really invested still at this point, and I wanted to know what was going on in his brain.
Up until the moment the ship goes 20 miles in the air, this movie is basically E.T. There's a mystery, there are kids that we like that we feel emotionally attached to. Something is going on and the kids are going to have to solve it.
Oh, yeah. Watching this, I understood why I remembered Henry Thomas as the navigator, even though he is the kid from E.T. A, the children do look the same. It's like a shaggy brown haircut, but it is a similar plot down to it being an expedition of an alien planet looking for specimens from Earth. Like, I'd hate to say ripped off, but I'm going to because it's a little bit ripped off.
So at this point, David and the ship are kind of mind melding or talking to each other, followed by a Skiing and Better Off Dead musical montage of the robot driving across the NASA facility. 5 years of my life went by.
The only thing that made it tolerable is that we got to see a bunch of medium shots of the 80s-est 80s guards in the world. Every single guard was like 2 years away from his debut in the International Mail catalog. Just like full ridiculousness. I laughed at every single new extra that was on screen.
And nobody had any questions. The robot can go wherever it needs to go. No one is just like, huh, I wonder what Ralph is doing here.
No, this is why you don't hire models as guards. None of them give a fuck about security, apparently.
I have to assume it's also why the mail was added to Ralph's responsibilities, because Ralph delivers food in this one facility, doesn't allow him to travel to, like, where we keep the spaceships we find.
It's just so clear that he is the exact size of a transport for a 12-year-old for no reason other than to transport a 12-year-old.
Indeed. So then we get a legitimately cool scene of David, who doesn't know that he knows this spaceship, getting introduced to it. It looks so forebodingly sciency in an early 1980s way that I love.
So the exterior of the ship is so smooth and sleek, and they comment earlier on that there's no seams anywhere on it. And then he gets inside and all of it is very square and brutalist, but also has a lot of really interesting details. Everything has etchings or carvings or some sort of like texturing on it. You expect it to be like the inside of a clamshell almost. And instead, it's this whole different aesthetic.
As you point out, like, it's slightly brutalist. It has all these like sort of vaguely organic, but also very geometric forms. The chair that David sits in, the fact that it has like butt pads for him, like all of the pieces of it really work well together. It's a beautiful piece of production, and it remains as cool as it was in 1986. And that being said, once they escape, which they do in short order after David enters the ship, some of the CGI is not bad for 1986.
Oh, I remember thinking that these were the most advanced special effects the planet could ever achieve. And while that is certainly not the case, you are right that it is, for its time, something that would have been completely revolutionary. Like, the specifics of the ship changing shape to that pointy model, that is burned in my brain because I had never seen anything like that as a child, and it blew me away.
Alongside the sort of mind-blowing CGI for kids, in the script, there is a lot of unpredictability in terms of how Max reacts. So the fact that David says, hey, take us 20 miles from here, and he takes them straight up, it is kind of very alien thinking. That still remained very cool.
Yeah, we've talked about how Max's new personality doesn't work. And I think that's because I was really bought into things like that. Because, again, there are instances where he seems to just legitimately not know what a word means, and that doesn't make sense. But having a different understanding of what a word means is very interesting. I thought this movie was going to be more about Max and David learning to communicate.
Yeah, like learning how to relate to each other.
And if we had had more hurdles like that of them having two different perspectives on the same objective truth or taking a word two different ways, that would have been much more interesting.
Yeah. And I have a ton of affection in my brain for him going, compliance. Absolute dopamine flooded my brain when Max said that. It's much more interesting to watch a young boy attempt to relate to an alien intelligence than it is for that boy to relate to his own brain.
You're right. Even little things, I didn't remember the word compliance specifically, but I really enjoyed it as an adult, because if you learned English from a dictionary you downloaded, that would be the thing that you thought you might say in that circumstance. It was a choice that conveyed something about the speaker that I found really incredible.
And I also want to give a shout out to Paul Rubens for also doing that part of the role. Like, he gets to lean into something that would have been a very comfortable character for him later in the movie. But early Max is so strange and weird and particular. And I think it's a much more interesting and challenging performance, also because I don't find it annoying, which I do find the back half of Max's performance annoying. But the fact that, like, Max picked up a kid as the representative of all humanity and is now also attempting to understand what he means and wants is interesting. And it's such a bummer that the movie like leaves that behind.
Yeah, we're just before the turning point where it essentially becomes a kid's movie. Once he figures out that he is, quote unquote, the navigator, it just becomes a weird wish fulfillment thing where he's like, I have a spaceship and I can do what I want. And like, the plot starts making way less sense. The characters start being much less relatable and much more annoying, and everything just becomes a joke.
It's a real shame, because right before that happens is, I think, one of the creepiest things that happens in the movie, where David gets to meet all the aliens, and they are Muppet-like, but just alien enough. I knew that there was something I didn't like, and I knew enough to look away when the sort of just like black box that David was looking into, because I did not like the eye, still don't like it, did not enjoy looking at it. No.
Right before that happened, I realized I had lodged in my brain a specific memory of just the single eye popping out of a black hole. I didn't know what it was from. I kind of assumed that it might be from a Star Wars movie or something. It was really interesting to put that in context, because that was just like a situationally neutral memory of a horrible thing. So it was a really complex emotion, because I did hate it, but I was so glad to know where it was from.
It's like solved a 30-year problem in your brain, basically.
Yeah, kind of. Is it just an eye? Because it's not a big enough compartment to house something for which that eyeball would fit.
I don't know. I don't really want to talk about it anymore, to be honest. It creeps me out just enough that I want to leave it alone. The last thing I'll say before we get to the part where Max totally changes his personality is the extremely sharp lesson that Max gives to David, where they fly way up in the air and David gives him some lip and he's like, okay, and just shuts down. I don't think we teach children in movies enough sharp-ass lessons these days.
It was weird for me, because it's not as though we believe Max would survive that fall either. So his lesson is essentially, I will kill myself and you if you're not 100% nice to me, which didn't feel like the best possible lesson.
I don't know. I feel like we should teach more young white males that lesson. Like, your bluff will be called and it's worth dying so that you stop being a dick.
I just hope that you never have a child who sasses you back in the car. I'd hate to see you just like aim for the wall and floor it and be like, apologize.
It's not, I will turn this car around. It's, I will drive this car directly into a brick wall.
We are going off this bridge until you're nice to mommy.
Luckily, this is a movie and they do work it out. And then it's like the back third of this movie. The only thing I remembered from it is Beach Boys, I Get Around, which, to be fair, is about the only thing that happens in the last 20 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, once he gets the brain scan, which has a couple problems. One, it sets up the fact that we're going to hint that something might be dangerous, and then, of course, he gets through it just fine. But B, it takes away Max, who has been half of the mystery up until now. Like, what Max is about is important. And to change his personality entirely erases the thing that we've been invested in.
Yeah, he functionally becomes human after that. It takes away the most compelling part of the movie, and all you're left with after that is very fast road trip, which is not interesting.
The logic from the studio was probably little boys will find it interesting to see a little boy pilot a spaceship that has a silly personality, and probably many of them did.
Can report that little girls also found it extremely interesting to be a kid and watch a kid pilot a spaceship.
I do have a fond memory of the argument between David and Max about which road to take to get home. I remember that being extremely amusing to me because it's a conversation that, like, my parents would have had. And so a boy arguing with his spaceship about whether to take the turnpike just tickled me.
I did not remember that part at all. I really remembered the cows, him peeing, I Get Around, and that's kind of it. And then David going home. Like, I don't have any recollection of Tokyo. Like, what also kind of starts to fall apart about the movie is that everything has been pretty specific, and then they're just in Tokyo, but then it seems to take more time to get back across the United States, and they don't know how to get back to Florida. Like, as we've established, there are like maps in David's brain, and Max has also scanned them. So presumably they're also in Max's brain. And like, Max knows how to get to David's house because that's where he took him from.
Well, Max knows how to get to David's old house. That was a logical problem that I had, is that David knows his new phone number because he can call his parents at their new place.
Oh, good point. When did he learn that?
But he shouldn't have any idea about any of that. This is a new home he's going to.
Which is the problem and why Jeff has to blow up all the fireworks in the world on July 4th. So I'm sure no one else would have been blowing up fireworks, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, if we know that he has maps, then the correct question is, what is the address of the new house?
I get the feeling that I probably appreciated it going off the rails in the way that it did a lot as a kid, because it is very just like kid fun, but it is not interesting. We see them go to Tokyo, and that's specific, and then they just drive across random parts of the US and we're like, mountains, grasslands, like, and it's daytime. They are together for what, 12 hours? Is that right?
Literally no idea. I also don't agree with the choice of the Beach Boys song. That's music that would have been popular in the year of David's birth, but he was disappeared in 1976. He would have been listening to like Donna Summer or something.
Yeah. And that moment felt so much more like 1980s nostalgia for the 60s. I have the exact same note.
And on a similar note, because they keep traveling to different places and stopping in different places, it felt weird that there wasn't a sense that they were trying to hide ever. Like, if they're actively being chased, it seems very likely that there would be reports left and right of UFO sightings, which they would want to avoid.
But there are. That's the thing, is like, does Max care about that? He doesn't seem to. Does David care about that? He doesn't seem to either. Like, David wants to get back to his, like, normal life with his parents, but he has now set up a situation where folks in Japan, folks in the Western Plains and mountains regions of the United States, as well as Florida, all know about him. The spaceship is driving at, like, 30 feet above the highway, presumably just in view of absolutely everyone. It's weird to like have a movie where the spaceship isn't trying to be secret.
And I get it that NASA's not going to, like, shoot him out of the air. They realize there's a 12-year-old boy.
I mean, we don't know they're keeping prisoners.
I suppose. But, like, it just sort of took the stakes away. In addition to there not being emotional seriousness, it just didn't feel like anything they were doing in this trip mattered.
That's the problem, is that right about the time that they switch over to Pee-wee Herman voice, the movie just slows down and loses all its momentum. The movie itself knows that we have to get to a point where David is unable to stay in this 1986 and needs to be returned to 1978. And so we know that that's where David's going to end up. And it just feels like they needed to kill 20 minutes. And then there's that kind of funny family who that man says that his wife needs to go to the little girl's room. And I almost jumped out of my skin. Because she's a grown woman, sir.
She sure is.
Jesus.
The other problem of taking the stakes away for that section is, as you said, we are building to a point where we're supposed to believe that David may or may not die from what's about to happen. And it's impossible to believe that they're going to follow through. I mean, I don't think any movie is going to end with, and the 12-year-old died. But
yes. See, this is why I'm not in charge of movie studios. I'd be like, yeah, ratchet those stakes up.
That's the thing, though, is that I should think it's at least possible. And we have spent so much time being zany that by the time he's like, well, I guess we'll risk it, I'm like, I think this motherfucker is going to be fine. Like, there's no worry.
That's the problem, is that this is a serious kids movie, which I love, with a wacky 20 minutes and then a very serious ending where, like, this kid now has a secret that he has to carry for the rest of his life.
And that secret is a weird little alien that he keeps in his backpack.
That thing is not as charming as the movie thinks it is. It is weird and it looks kind of greasy. I don't hate it, but I don't love it.
It was another one of those things. A, it again feels like studio intervention that we need a cute thing. I can't imagine they didn't at least try to make merch out of that little thing.
That thing was, I'm sure, was like a McDonald's Happy Meal toy.
But it also just makes the plot feel ridiculous, because instead of the end being an emotional connection with his family again, it's like, we're going to play with our fun little pet at the end. Like, just tell your brother that you love him and leave it alone.
I feel like the serious part of the movie was trying to make a connection between David, who is now functionally an orphan because he is out of space and time with everyone he knows. If he stays in 1986, he is always going to feel alone. And so they try to pair him with this little critter who has also lost his entire family and planet and sense of self. And then they're just like, but Pee-wee's Playhouse. So they just, like, don't stick the landing on that at all because they stop caring.
100,000%. If we had simply had reference to one of these creatures having lost its planet and then never seen it again, that would have been the right way to handle this.
That's right. Not like it lives in a backpack.
How big will it get?
Oh God, how big will it get? Maybe it's a baby. I mean, we know that Max is just choosing random ass, like, it's not like David's the most prime specimen anyone's ever, like, found in the entire world.
Yeah, I mean, we're lucky it even breathes oxygen.
Maybe it does. Jesus. Oh, God. I'm sure the little thing was fine. It was fine.
I guess if NASA finds out, then they're going to be on his ass right quick. Out of the frying pan, into the fire, kiddo.
So, you know, we've sort of alluded to the end of the movie. Max and David eventually make it back. The police are there. It's a whole scene. His brother has lit all the fireworks so he can find his way home. And then there's, like, a very tearful scene between Max and David, which I don't want to sound like just a cynical bastard, but I'm like, these two have spent 12 hours together and Max is no longer even the personality of the creature that you started this out with. So, like, what bond have they really made?
You can feel that being a leftover from the movie that this probably wanted to be, which is that the two of them learned to communicate over the course of their journey and then had to suddenly come to terms with the fact that Max might kill this kid.
And at the very least, they won't be able to be friends anymore because they come from different worlds, which is, like, one of the classic sad children partings, right?
Yeah, like, they're hoping that these two would have formed, like, an E.T. style bond, but they turned Max into the zany character that they think kids want to be friends with, rather than letting him go on a journey of, like, mutual growth.
But that's, like, not who kids actually want to, like, form a bond with. David was desperately looking for a parent and some guidance because he wasn't actually feeling connected with the family that he had in 1986. This kid is literally making a life or death choice, and so much of the stakes of that have been thrown away by a road trip with cows.
Yeah, it's the ending for a movie they didn't make.
You really do see, like, the influence of the mouse on this. Do we have any final thoughts about Flight of the Navigator, or should we just keep it moving and you should tell us what we're going to watch next week?
I'll just say that I think, in spite of the flaws we found, I would encourage everyone to watch this. I had a great time, had a couple good cries. It's got more depth than you'd expect, and I really do recommend it as a film overall.
Yeah, I found the back third more annoying than I would have remembered. That being said, I think Joey Kramer is really doing some great work here as David. Overall, I think it's a fun kids movie. If you have kids, you could do worse than showing them Flight of the Navigator. But there's also, like, an hour of a story that will keep parents engaged as well. So, you know, do you.
All right. We've got an Instagram at Replaying Favorites, a Twitter at Replaying Faves, and we're on iTunes and anywhere else you can get podcasts. iTunes is where you can give us a 5-star rating and a lovely review. I would love for you to do both of those things because it helps other people find us and love us. And good God, do we need attention? I can't stress that enough.
You have in so many episodes.
Look, I know myself and I know what I need. Well, on that note, we do have to move on to next week's film. I wanted to do something that was the opposite of the film that we just watched, and I don't think there's a way to go more opposite than The Silence of the Lambs.
That's pretty opposite, like a gritty psychological thriller. Sure. All right.
Yeah. It's a great movie. The Oscars certainly thought so, and hopefully you'll agree next week. So everyone, watch it. And then come back and talk about it with us. Bye.
Bye.
Do you think that once I can see people in person, my need for internet validation will lessen? Because I have some harsh news for you about that.